Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you today. I'm very honored to have back on the show Lawrence Juber. Lawrence, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Lawrence was on earlier when I had Christopher Rodriguez of the LA Unified School District, and we were talking about the music program, which Lawrence is heavily involved in. And also, Lawrence is involved in guitars in the classroom with our mutual friend, Jessica Barron, which I want to shout out to her.
Yay, Jessica.
And but I wanted to do a show. It was obvious that we needed to do a show to focus on Lawrence's playing and specifically all that he's done. And as I was doing the research, I was just blown away by what he is. He's much more than just guitar, if I can say it that way. I mean, he graduated from the University of London. He won a Grammy with I think the song was the Rockestra Three with Wings. But he was the guitar player for the Spy Who Loved Me soundtrack. He's done... And he played on one of my favorite albums of all time, the Alan Parsons Project's Tales of Mystery and Imagination.
But I didn't know it.
You didn't know.
I didn't know it.
Before we get in and start playing some of the music that you have, you told me to mention that there's a story behind that.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a session player in London. It was always my ambition was to be a studio guitar player. You know, I mean, I enjoyed playing live, and it just was, the session world was just the thing that really attracted me because I loved the sound of records, and I'd listen to, you know, all the different parts on the records. And I guess, you know, looking back on it, the arranger in me was already starting to kind of germinate. And I went through my teenage years, like, gigging around London, and then I was a pioneer of what they now call the gap year. I took a year off after high school and just worked, and then went to London University, got my degree, which was in music theory and musicology. I didn't study guitar there because there was really no way that in London that you could study kind of studio guitar. I mean, that was kind of, you know, self-study, essentially. And I was playing with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra because I learned to sight read very early on. In fact, one afternoon out of a book called Play in a Day, written by a man named Burt Whedon, and in the back of the book was When the Saints Go Marching In, and it was like, okay, so that's this and that's this, and it just made perfect sense. I mean, I didn't have to struggle with it. You know, later it became more kind of complicated, but to begin with, the basics kind of came to me very quickly. And so I, after college, I got straight into studio work. I was a contractor, what in England we call them fixers, but somebody would book musicians for sessions. A man named David Katz, and he'd seen me on television with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, and he called me up the next day and said, he called everybody darling. He said, oh, darling, I've got some sessions for you. And I said, well, David, thank you for calling, but those are my final exams on those 2 days. And I just couldn't not, you know, having been through college, I couldn't skip the finals. So I didn't think I'd hear from him again, but he called a couple of weeks later and just got me into it, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. And for a period, I was just really busy. You know, it was like 3 sessions a day, 7 days a week kind of stuff. And one Tuesday night, I was at Abbey Road in Studio 2, and there you never went upstairs. You never went up that long staircase to the control room because you were a musician. You know, you were in the studio. And there was an orchestra, and there was Francis Monkman was playing harpsichord from Curved Air, and there was some mandolins, and we did this track, and it was kind of cool and kind of quasi-classical, and I didn't think any more of it until years later. There used to be a magazine called Musician, and they were interviewing Alan Parsons, and he said, oh, and we had Lawrence Stuber come and play acoustic guitar. We did. I had no idea. So I went and bought the CD, and sure enough, my name was on the credits. They'd actually left my name off the credits of the vinyl, so, you know, I had no idea about it.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing any credits of that on the...
No, it wasn't.
Because I got the record at that time.
No, it was... But on the CD, actually...
How big was the orchestra in that? Because that's a small room.
It was like a string
room.
Section, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not that small. I mean, you could actually get a pretty decent-sized orchestra in Studio 2. I couldn't tell you how many strings. I mean, probably like 12 violins.
And what guitar did you use? Acoustic?
That would have been... That was, I think, before my... Well, I had a Guild F50 that was just a killer sounding guitar, and that was stolen, and then I replaced it with another one which wasn't as great, but that's probably what I was playing.
The Guild F50.
Yeah. Which was kind of not really what you think of as a studio guitar, but it sounded good.
Do you remember which song it was?
It's the Pavan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was there's an instrumental section.
It's an instrumental thing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That was Andrew Powell was doing it.
Yeah, Andrew Powell was, and he was the one who kind of wanted me on it. In fact, Andrew and I subsequently worked, many years later, we worked together. I brought him in when I did the first album I did with Al Stewart, Between the Wars. We had a track, Laughing Into 1939, that we had Andrew do a kind of a keyboard string arrangement for.
So. Oh, okay.
But I haven't seen him. I haven't seen Andrew probably since about 90, since maybe about 20 years, I think.
Now. Wow. Yeah. No, and I think you also, because of your relationship with him, you were on the Lady Hawk album too, right?
Yeah, that was. They were recording in L.A. and they needed a lutenist. And I still have my, you know, I have a Renaissance lute, and I'm in the Union book because, you know, once in a while, can you play at a wedding? And I said, no, I don't do that. but I got a call to play lute on Lady Hawk. So, you know,
I mean, that's another great score. That's a really Andrew Powell's a great.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, he's really well. He did, you know, like Year of the Cat. I mean, that whole huge string arrangement. That's it.
Yeah, that one in Time Passages was another one that he had done that was really beautiful.
Although when Al and I used to tour together as a duo, we would do Time Passages as an Irish jig.
Oh, that.
Because Al, and now he does it more like the, you know, the record, but there was a period where he was kind of like disavowing the, I think he heard it in an elevator once and thought it was elevator music until he realized it was his own record, and then kind of wanted to change it up a bit.
No, years ago I did get to go to Abbey Road, and I met one of the engineers there, and he talked about them, about Andrew Powell, and I said, how did he get that sound? That string sound was huge. And he said it wasn't that big of a section. It's the way he wrote it.
It's the way he writes. There's a lot of divisi kind of like dividing.
Yeah, and it's just huge. I mean, it's all those albums are just excellent.
Yeah, I was very fortunate in working with people like him and Del Newman.
Del Newman.
Yeah, and Del took over from, what's his name, who did the early Elton records. I can't think of his name now.
Paul Buckmaster.
Yeah, Paul Buckmaster, yeah. And in fact, Del produced when I played on the Rosemary Clooney album, Del was the producer on that. And also we did a whole bunch of stuff with Charles Aznavour. In fact, there was one Charles Aznavour album I played on in Paris. that I didn't know until I read it on my own Wikipedia page was number one in France for a year. It's like the stuff you learn, you know, it's like, I had no idea. But that's the thing about being a studio musician is you don't always know what you're playing on. You know, sometimes I think it's a demo, and it turns out to be, you know.
Well, like with Clooney
from
or
the Lion King.
Clooney or Barry Manilow, were you playing acoustic or were you playing electric guitar?
Both.
Oh, okay. So you would be.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't just. I've never been just an acoustic guy. It's just that playing fingerstyle, as I do, is naturally an acoustic instrument, and it just was something that I specialized in. Especially once I got to L.A. where there's like a plethora of great electric guitar players. And I had, I have my thing that I do as an electric player. I mean, having played lead guitar for Wings, that was the main part of the job. But also to be versatile. I mean, that's what really got me that, and I fit the suit.
Yeah. definitely. Well, let me go ahead. I'm going to play this cut, which... I think this is from the live album, Catch LJ Live. And I heard this when you played at the Fret House just before you were on the show with Christopher Rodriguez, which, by the way, is the one, if you want to look it up in the archives, it was on May 22nd, and you can download it and check out what we did. And also he wrote some pieces for the kids to play, and there's this like guitar orchestra piece that he wrote that's brilliant. But this piece he played, and I just thought it was really cool the way he got all the little nuances. This is a Hendrix tune. It's called Little Wing. And it's a very inventive arrangement, and I just like all the little kind of cool things you're doing. So let me play it, and you can tell us a little bit about how you arranged this. As I was playing that, I was trying to edit that, and it's like every time you did something else, you were just doing just amazing little fills and
well, thanks. The truth is, I never actually arranged that song. It just kind of arranged itself, and it just started. Somebody said, "Oh, play Little Wing," and I on stage one night, and I played it, and then people kept asking for it. So it just kind of, I mean, I played the tune, and I figured out a few little interconnecting bits. And now, actually, I tend to open it up and get a lot more improvisational with it now, too, and just let it be completely freeform. You know, there's kind of structure in there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of evolved into its own thing over the years, but it just, whereas a lot of the stuff I do is very specifically, you know, arranged. I mean, where I'm really kind of figuring out where all the parts are going to sit. And but that one, it just kind of it grew. It was organic.
Yeah, no, but it has that kind of a improvisational feel to it. I just thought it was great the way you know, in the original one, he's using the whammy board, and you get that by sliding down. But you do cool little harmonic things, and you're doing all sorts of little, and then the riffs, you're getting the
it's all
little
guitar stuff, you know.
Yeah, but that's what it is. Now, I want to ask you something too, because if you on that piece that was live, but the sound of the guitar, was that the your signature Martin?
Actually, that was a version of my signature Martin. That one was a maple one.
A maple.
Yeah, we actually did it in maple, and just happened to be the one that was, you know, when we did that, it was a video and an audio recording.
Because
just happened to be the one that was working for me at that time.
Because I noticed that you get a real, and when I saw you play at the Fret House, you had a really bright sound, but I just noticed that you don't have any nails. How do you get a really bright sound with no nails?
Well, I think the part of it is just, you know, when you're hearing it live also, you've got, you know, there are layers of electronics involved in terms of a pickup and a mic and whatever the PA happens to be doing with the high end, too. But pretty much, I mean, what I'm going for is just tone, you know. And just using the flesh to, you know, to pick with, and it gets the job done. I didn't like the sound I was getting with nails. It was too clicky.
Now, are you using a light gauge or
No, this is actually, it's kind of a true medium light. It's 13, 17, 24, 32, 42, 56. So it's medium, medium, light, 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 medium. So when I'm in dadgad tuning, like I am right now, then the tension is pretty even. In standard tuning, it, you know, makes them a little, the upper strings get a little stiffer, but because I play pretty hard, I like the strings to be able to have, you know, to clear the frets and not.
Yeah, it doesn't shatter too much. Now, the Little Wing is regular tuning?
That's standard.
Standard tuning. Yeah. Well, let's play another clip. Actually, you were talking about some of the percussive things you're doing, and I think this one's a good example, is Hey Bulldog. So let me play this, and this is from your latest album, LJ Can't Stop Playing the Beatles.
Yeah, that's my third album of Beatles.
Yes. And now, and again, before we play this, this is what you were talking about being a more structured.
Yeah, this is really kind of arranged.
So you
there's really no improvisation.
You're not drifting. You don't take it somewhere.
Other than just interpretive, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. But
okay, well, let's take a listen. This is Hey Bulldog. Thank you. I just love the counterpoint. You have all these amplifiers.
Yeah, it's two hands on the fingerboard.
But again, the tone of the guitar is so bright. Now, which
that's
one?
That's this guitar.
That's the one that you have here in the studio.
But there's also a lot of bottom end in there, too. I mean, it's the thing is that you want the clarity so that the voices can, you know, can really speak out, so that there's room to kind of shape the sound.
But the timbre of those the string sound, the timbre, the overtones, is just to die for. That's just a great... Now, are you using Martin strings, or are you using...
Yeah, it's a signature set that I have with them. They have a series called Retro, which is Monel. It's not phosphor bronze. Monel is a copper nickel iron alloy. And it's what a lot of people used those in the 30s, and then it kind of fell out of favor, except amongst bluegrass, like mandolin players. And then they brought it back recently. And in fact, there was a Tony Rice set, and they said, "Well, try these." And I tried them, and the gauging wasn't right, but it was like, "Oh, this is kind of different. It's a stronger fundamental than you get with phosphor bronze.
Mm-hmm.
Less of the fizz. You know, there's a certain fizzy harmonic thing that." And I, you know, it's like the same thing with brass strings. I never went for the brass stuff. But what I'm looking for is just the voice. What brings out a more vocal tone?
Right. Well, that when you, especially when you're tapping and stuff, the overtones of that, it's just rich and it's clear. But it's even in your middle voices when you're going in, it's all clear. It's really, really clear.
Well, especially when I'm doing, you know, kind of these kinds of, like, you know, more jazzy voicings. You know, which dadgad tuning really lends itself to this kind of, that kind
and,
of
and Bulldog was...
Stuff. That's in dadgad.
Dadgad.
Yeah, and it's just, it's a tuning that just gives you all kinds of, or gives me all kinds of stuff to work with, and the fact that you can play a ninth chord like that, you know, whereas in standard tune, I mean, you can't really, you know, it's radio, so I can't really demonstrate, but it's the kind of stretching that you would have to do in order to get that in standard tuning. It's just, you know, maybe Tal Farlow could do it, but I have small fingers. So,
no, it's just amazing, and through all these clips that I pulled from the show, the way you, like... Well, I'll play this other one, and your bird can sing. Is that...
That's standard tuning.
That's standard tuning.
And I was really... What I was going for with this, because, you know, it's all parallel thirds. I was really... And I'd been playing a lot of 19th century music, and it just struck me that by, you know, squeezing both of those parts onto one guitar instead of, you know, because on the record it's Paul and George playing in harmony, that it just felt like classical. But not kind of Spanish classical, but, you know, kind of early 19th century.
But what also blew me away is your bass line, how it just, it's a very cool line, and how you integrate that with what you're doing. You do a lot of counterpunnel, like bass.
Well, I'm the bass player, too.
Yes.
You know? And I've played with just, you know, one or two great bass players over the years.
Yeah. All right, let me go ahead and play this clip, and then we can take a look at what you did with it.
Okay.
This is "And Your Bird Can Sing." Thank you. So you can hear in there, you do these great bass runs. Uh-huh. They're just really cool. Now, you switch guitars.
Well, this happens to be in standard tuning.
Oh, okay.
Because it's a very different sound to that, because it's a much older, much smaller.
Well, you must explain what you're playing right now, because this is a
1893 Martin 121. So that size one is the one below the single aught. Because their sizing is weird. It's like it's backwards. Like the smallest one they make is a size 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then the biggest one is, apart from the dreadnought, is like the 4-aught. So you kind of go 5-4-3-2-1, and then 0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-
originally designed for nylon strings.
Forget strings. Yeah, 1893, they didn't have nylon.
No nylon.
It was gut.
But he has steel strings on this, and it just, it's amazing sound.
Yeah, it's a cool sounding instrument. I mean,
now what's the back and sides on that?
Brazilian rosewood.
That is Brazilian rosewood.
Yeah. Brazilian rosewood. With an Adirondack spruce top, too. Yeah.
Oh wow! Yeah,
it's actually kind of a fun studio guitar because it sits in such a different space. You know.
What's amazing about these smaller guitar, would that be considered a parlor guitar?
Oh, totally, yeah.
Is how loud it is. Now, he's playing in the same position. Now, he had the larger Martin, the other guitar, his signature model, and he's basically in the same position. That thing is just in your face. It's right there.
Well, it's got some age behind it.
But, I mean, it's really a live guitar.
It's very light. You know, the tops on these are pretty thin. It's amazing that they can handle steel strings. I mean, it's an extra light steel, extra light set, but very thin top. And, you know, of course, Brazilian rosewood has, you know, projection, and Adirondack spruce has projection, and it's old.
It's over 100 years old.
Oh, yeah, well over 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing, because usually people have said, like, after 50 years, they start deteriorating.
Yeah, I was just in the Martin Museum a month or so ago, and we were videoing me playing a bunch of different guitars. I mean, like a 1838, you know, Stauffer-style one.
Oh,
and
wow.
Something from 1880, and then there was a Foden special. William Foden was, like, the kind of the wizard of the guitar in America around the turn of the 20th mm-hmm. century. And then his kind of opposite pole was Vada Orkut Bickford, and there was the Orkut Bickford model. And I played both of their models, which was really kind of remarkable stuff. And they all sound great. I mean, those instruments, you know, especially because they were not, there was no amplification in those days. There were guitars made. There was a maker in London in the 1830s named Rudolph, who made what he called the mellophonic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that it was, we know that it was an X-braced instrument. Because X-bracing had really been used only on like gittern type things with like steel strings, mm-hmm. you know, or what they call wire strings. And Rudolph, when they presented this guitar at a concert in London, there was a kid named Rigondi who was like virtuoso player, and he played this mellophonic guitar to an audience of 700 people, and apparently it was like a sensation. But there was just a basic expectation that, you know, people's awareness of how sound was expected to project. And, of course, concert halls were built to enhance the natural mm-hmm, acoustic mm-hmm. sound. But modern audiences have become so kind of used to the amplification that it's hard to just go out there and do something purely acoustic. But once in a while, I actually get to do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, even most recordings, especially classical, they mic everything, which sometimes doesn't. It's sometimes better just to use the, you know, just get a couple of mics and just get the room.
Yeah, you don't want to do a close mic thing necessarily.
Yeah.
In fact, when I did my first album, Solo Flight, which I did in 1990, Some of the recording I did, we actually didn't do any close miking. We actually did like distant miking. But over the years, I've just got used to doing it, more of a close mic thing.
So the new album, you did do that, or do you? Or
My recent albums. I mean, for the last probably 20 years, you know, just two mics, pair of Sheps CMC5, so small mm-hmm. diaphragm condensers. I used to use a XY, but more recently I've been doing kind of a modified ORTF, which is the French radio mm-hmm. engineers, which is, what is it? It's like 90 degrees, no, 110 degrees. And, you know, it's basically meant to be like the distance between your ears.
Right.
And it just, you know, that seems to work out pretty
How
well.
Far from the guitar?
Probably about 18 inches. 18
inches?
Not too
inches?
Close, yeah.
Now,
but I don't really do any EQ, for example. I mean, I just try and get the tone.
You work
right.
with the mic to get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. With the Sheps, they're really accurate.
Yeah, they're pretty accurate.
Yeah. But the do you ever try to, when you're, because you go all over the world and stuff, have you ever just, like, bring a pair of mics and a recorder, and if you're in a really cool room, like, you know, do you try to record in there?
Typically not. Because when I play, most of the time when I'm doing concerts, I'm playing standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to move around, so you know it's kind of tricky to do that kind of recording. And you know, there's no reason for me to be recording kind of stuff that is already kind of standard repertoire.
No, that's true.
For me. But right now I'm working on a bunch of new tunes that are a little more in the jazz direction, and I'm gonna start recording some of that stuff because I want to capture, you know, what's going on live.
So you're gonna do like a live section?
I don't know.
I mean, you don't know yet if you're going to use a band or you're going to do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have my trio. I mean, my Christmas album, which came out mm-hmm. last year, was a trio record. In fact, we did some gigs and then went into Capitol and recorded the whole album in 6 hours. So I
That's
like
cool.
to do that kind of thing.
But with a good room, though, just to get the group and just... Nothing beats that. I mean,
no, it's nothing like, you know, live. But the fact is that, you know, the economics and the... just the general kind of marketing parameters of doing solo acoustic guitar actually is more, potentially more marketable than doing like a jazz record.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I mean, you always use two mics on your guitar.
Oh, yeah.
So you're always...
Unless there's a reason just to do one mic. But for my solo stuff, certainly,
yeah.
Two mics. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it, the way you mic it, it definitely gets a rich sound. You're getting a really... really full sound. But let's talk a little bit about your signature guitar and the mm-hmm. both of these guitars, because I want to know what you were asking of Martin in terms of what did you want in a guitar, what developed, how did your guitar evolve, your model?
It was really me calling up. I had actually, there was a period in the 90s where I was a clinician for Taylor Guitars.
Mm-hmm.
When I first got involved with them, switching guitars. When I first got involved with them, they were making 10 guitars a day.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got done with working with them, they were making 200 a day. And that was in the space of maybe 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a very rapid growth. And for a period, I was playing Collings guitars. And I'd really, Eric Schoenberg was the one who kind of turned me onto the OM, the orchestra model, as being really the ideal fingerstyle guitar. And I had a few Collings OMs, and I was a music messer in Frankfurt, which is like the NAMM show on mm-hmm. steroids. And I had a relationship for a period with Tacoma, were making kind of low-end guitars, and I did some work with them to come up with like a $500 solid wood American-made guitar. But they just didn't have the marketing capability, and so that kind of fizzled. And then I was at the Music Messer and started hanging out with Dick Boak from Martin, who at the time was the artist relations. Now he's in charge of the archive, which is actually a very hip gig. And we bonded, and I got back and I called him up and said, you know, I should have a Martin OM. So I said, I want the custom shop to make me an OM with a cutaway and a 2 1/4 inch string strip spacing at the bridge rather than 2 3/16, which is the more common mm-hmm. modern spacing, which is still less than the 2 5/16, which is the more like vintage mm-hmm. approach. But doing 2 1/4, it gives me 2 1/4 at the 12th fret, and doing kind of, you know, these kind of bar chords at the 13th fret is very hard with that extra little, even if it's a 16th of an inch, it just makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So I wanted basically something that was like a traditional OM, so I had Adirondack spruce for the top. And this was an 18, so it was mahogany. And it was basically a modern performance version of a kind of what I conceived at the time to be a vintage Martin. As time went on, they've offered more vintage features, so it's kind of evolved. But that guitar turned out so well that they said, well, do you want to do it as a signature model? And so that was a limited edition. And then that went well, and I said, well, can we do it again? And I said, well, can we do it in Madagascar rosewood? And they said, no, we can't get it, but we'll do Brazilian, which I didn't even dare ask for Brazilian rosewood. So we did a limited edition of 50. And then they also did an edition in Indian rosewood, which I was kind of leery about because I'm not a huge fan of Indian rosewood. But as time's gone on, the Indian Adirondack combinations actually proved to be really cool. And then they got Madagascar rosewood, so we did an open edition there. And then I've tried it in maple, like in the live stuff that you played. And then Koa, we did an edition in Koa.
How'd you like the Koa?
Oh, the Koa's really cool. I mean, and that was with a Spanish cedar neck, too. It was an OM-44, and the style 44 is basically like the top of the lime woods, but without all the bling. Still had the herringbone, but that was about it. Herringbone. Bite.
What's your favorite rosewood of the guitars that you had made? I mean, or how
of,
can you?
Of all of them right now, my favorite is this one, which is a Guatemalan rosewood, which is kind of first cousin to Brazilian. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't have an Adirondack top. This has a high alpine Swiss moon spruce top. Moon spruce being spruce that's cut on the waning moon, because the sap is at its lowest in that part of the lunar cycle, so you get a drier log. Now they're doing something called torrefaction, where they kind of suck all the moisture out, which actually, you know, is an artificial way of aging it.
Right.
This is a natural way of doing the same thing, because they claim that it's about 15 years worth of aging that comes out of it being...
Right.
Moon spruce, and this is the stuff that Stradivarius used, I mean the high alpine stuff, except that in his era, that was the era of what they called, the meteorologists called, the Maunder minimum, which was something to do with the sunspot cycle, where the summers were very short and very wet, so you had trees that were growing high up in the Alps with very short wet summers, so very, very tight grained, because the growing season was so short. And that may be part of the secret of Stradivarius's violins.
Now, is that horsehide glue, the old
one? Yeah,
way?
It's hide glue.
And that's the...
hide glue. Hide whether glue. It's from horses or cows or whatever, I don't know.
And then is that a nitrocellulose?
It's a lacquer finish.
An old style, so it's basically...
Yeah, old school, yeah. So. And it's a thin finish, too. The only thing is, I mean, what they do with the authentics is that they tuck in the braces, which was the old way of doing it. They tuck the braces into the kerfing, which they don't do with these in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But this is about as close as you can get to kind of their vintage spec without going into the authentic realm, which they only do in their authentic series. But as time's gone on, their custom shop kind of opened up. And for me, I also, what happened in my relationship with Dick Boak was that he and I ended up, we've been doing what I call Guitar Mania to Beatlemania, which is basically a history of the guitar that dovetails with the history of Martin guitars. So I have a slideshow that I do with that. And I've got my own version of it, having done it with Dick a number of times. We've done it like at the Met in New York, and the Musical Instrument Museum in Scottsdale and places like that. It's really kind of a fun thing, especially when we do it in a museum environment where there's like an array of vintage Martins on stage, and I get to, you know, sit on stage.
That's it. And it's great. Yeah, you can hear, because you can hear the difference. I mean, when I had Snuffy on with his pre-war Martins, there's a reason you can hear it in the guitar. It's just right there.
Yeah.
And I asked him, do you do any processing? And he's like, no, I just record straight, just like you do.
Yeah, it's in the fingers.
It's definitely, yeah. No,
there's a great story about Chet Atkins and Les Paul recording together for the Chester and Lester album that mm-hmm. I did, and Les walks into the studio and says, "Oh, that's such a great sounding guitar, Chet." And Chet puts it on the guitar stand and he says, "How does it sound now?"
That's great. Yeah. No, the so there's so many different models now. So what's available now? You said there was a limited
one.
Yeah,
this one is, there's a store in Florida, My Favorite Guitar, mm-hmm. that they've been ordering these through the custom shop in small batches. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, whiskey, you kind of do the small batch thing.
Now, none of the other ones are available?
Well,
anymore?
They're, you know, they're out there in cyberspace. I mean, there's an mm-hmm. aftermarket. I know of an Indian Rosewood one that's just becoming available in Chicago. But, you know, we've done over the course of what is now, I guess, 15, 16 years, we've done, you know, we've sold over 500 of these, which is pretty cool. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not at the level of like the Clapton model, but to have have a long run like that of doing multiple incarnations of a guitar like this has been, you know, kind of an honor for me, really.
Have you ever thought about making one with a cedar top?
Yes, but I wouldn't do a Martin with a cedar top. It just is not right.
Doesn't work?
No, I mean, I played a cedar Taylor for a while. Yeah. But the thing about cedar is if you hit it hard, it gets crunchy. It doesn't have the same headroom. And you know, cedar on a nylon string, you know, cedar and Indian rosewood, for example, is a great combination because right. you get the warmth, that chocolatey warmth of Indian rosewood, but the cedar can cut through that. And cedar has, you know, a nice warmth sound to it. My first album, Solo Flight, I did on a guitar made by an English maker named John Lavoie, which was a cedar top with an Imbuya body. Which is an interesting combination, and that's almost like a kind of a folk guitar more mm-hmm. than a, you know, more than the Martin. I mean, the Martin has such an Americana sound to it.
It's got a distinct sound to it.
Well, it is. I mean, Martin really invented the American acoustic guitar, so you know, it makes sense.
Yeah. What do you think? Have you experimented with any of the? Because I know Martin's looking at other woods like cherry wood and. Mm-hmm. And have you played around with those, or what are your impressions?
I really haven't. I mean, I played, you know, the occasional one, but it's hard to quantify. I mean, the great thing about what I've done is that I have a series of guitars that are all the same model with comparable tops that with the different woods. So you can line up, you know, maple versus koa, and you can hear the difference.
Right.
But at the end of the day, the top is more important than the body wood. Mm-hmm. And I'm still, you know, a lot of the time I'll gravitate to a mahogany guitar. For writing, I tend to play.
Really?
Yeah. I have the same guitar in mahogany, and it's warm and woody. You know, it just has a, you can really kind of shape the sound.
But you still like the rosewood for recording.
No, I a lot of the time, if I'm turning up on a session, I'll take a mahogany guitar.
Oh, okay.
It's just this particular guitar has a voice, and I've done my last two albums with it, and will probably continue to do so. Mm-hmm. I think I'm done in terms of experimentation at this point. I mean, unless something remarkable comes up, if I could do anything, I would try this with the moon spruce, with maple, with German maple.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah, because maple has tremendous projection,
mm-hmm.
But it doesn't give you back anything. So for an amateur player, maple doesn't make a lot of sense. Because like an Indian rosewood guitar will kind of embrace you with its own reverb
right.
and sound. But I want projection, so Indian rosewood doesn't give me that. You know, and players that use nails or use finger picks, Indian rosewood can be great.
Right.
It's also more affordable.
Well, the thing is that the, you know, future generations of guitar players in the next maybe 20 years, we might not see too many rosewood guitars anymore. That's the sad part about it. It's becoming so scarce.
Well, it isn't that it's that scarce, because it is sustainable. It's just that what's been happening is that so much rosewood has been going to China for furniture. That's what happened in Madagascar, was that the Chinese were basically like just extracting 99% of the available Madagascar rosewood, and you know, this tiny sliver of it came over to the guitar. And there's also different kinds of rosewood. I mean, in Madagascar, there's Dalbergia baroni, which is the kind of more common one, but there's also Dalbergia maritima, Dalbergia being the Latin name for rosewood. And that one supposedly is the cool one, but you can't really get it very easily. But, you know, the holy grail wood is probably Cuban mahogany.
Really?
Which has been functionally extinct for about 200 years. So once in a while, a guitar will show up made out of Cuban mahogany, but which actually plays more like rosewood than a more traditional mahogany.
Why? When did that disappear? When did it become?
Well, they used to use it for like, you know, decking on galleons and stuff.
Oh.
Like that.
What we're going to have to do is we're going to have to go to China and raid furniture stores to get the rosewood.
Yeah.
But, no, it's interesting because that mahogany, I always thought was a little, the rosewood was a mellower overall sound. It had a little edgier sound, the mahogany.
Mahogany depends on the top. You know, you put a Sitka top on mahogany and you're going to get a fairly bright guitar out of it. You put an Adirondack top on mahogany, you're going to get more depth out of it because Adirondack just gives you that extra bottom end, as does the European spruce, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that bottom octave is down, you know, down the bottom there. You don't get that with Sitka spruce in the same way.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
And you certainly don't get it with cedar. Cedar just doesn't have that kind of bottom end.
Yeah, it's a little, the one that I know that uses cedar a lot with on his Taylors is Jim Kima West.
Right. And well, that's different because he's playing, you know, when you're playing Hawaiian-style stuff, too, there's that warmth works rather nicely. You know, again, it's style-dependent. Depends on who's making the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to be completely, you know, generalized about it. I mean, one of the coolest-sounding guitars I ever had was a Kevin Ryan that was Indian rosewood and cedar, so...
Yeah. Well, just an aside, he uses a baritone Tacoma, which probably was influenced by your work there, because it's a solid
maybe,
wood
yeah.
one.
Yeah, maybe.
He loves that thing. It sounds great.
Yeah.
It's a great sounding guitar.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time. But
oh, no.
What I wanted
to... Can I play a tune for you before we go?
Sure, sure.
This is mine. This is cobalt blue. The short running out
that's
of time.
I just love the sound of that guitar. His latest album is LJ Can't Stop Playing the Beatles. And I recommend it. I make all of them. The Beatle, LJ Plays the Beatles, Volume 2, Volume 1, Fingerboard Road, and this Catch LJ Live is a killer, and it has a DVD in it, too. Yeah. So
I mean, I've done, I think, 25 or 26 albums. So.
You've done a lot.
And we haven't had a question about Paul McCartney yet, which is...
Oh, I wanted to ask you real quick is, and I, of course, I got it. When we started talking about the history of Martin, I just wanted to ask you, what was the biggest, whether it was a music technique or style composition, and what influenced that playing with McCartney? What was the biggest impression in your playing in your career?
The deepest lesson was never to smuggle marijuana into Japan. And then the other one was not to give up your music publishing, because you know, Michael Jackson ended up, you know, taking Paul's advice and buying a publishing catalog. It just happened to be the Beatles catalog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was. I like to think of it that I got my master's degree from McCartney University. I mean, I really learned a lot about a lot of different things. But I think the greatest thing for me was the opportunity, because as a studio musician, I was always in front of a music stand. But being in Wings, I got to be in the control room, and I got to watch, you know, engineers like Jeff Emerick kind of doing their thing and seeing, you know, what mics they use, where they put them, and the whole process, the whole record making process. And then beyond that, into the marketing end of it, you know, it's like photo sessions and press conferences and going out and doing radio tours, and, you know, just the whole business of doing it really kind of gave me a foundation from when I started doing my own thing. And just more than anything else, from a creative perspective, the fact that I had studied all this music, but I never thought of myself as a composer, because I wanted to be a studio player. And so, you know, being a composer was kind of not on my radar. And then working with Paul and seeing how he did it, and, you know, the work ethic behind it, and the fact that you don't have to wait for like lightning to hit you, you know, on the side of the head to, you know, get inspiration. You simply sit down and you do it. And that gave me a path forward to really recognize that I could be a composer too. And then, you know, the irony of it being that as time went on with my solo acoustic stuff, I became more and more of an arranger, which I also didn't realize that I had the talent for, but it just became very natural to me, because at the basis of it all was music, was making music, and how the substance of music, which the substance of music transcends style. I mean, for me, I can listen to Mozart, I can listen to Django Reinhardt, I can listen to Hendrix, just whatever it is. I mean, speed metal gets a little beyond my, you know, my comfort zone, but you know, I mean, I did a session the other day with my friend Mark Hudson, and you know, I had to play this kind of really punky guitar solo. I love doing stuff like that. I think in another universe, I would have been in a heavy metal band, I think.
Oh, that's cool.
Because I love that, but you know, kind of not the way the metal kind of evolved, but the basic kind of roots.
It's just fun, the diversity you get, and it really challenges you musically, just doing different things.
Yeah, and just making music, and whatever it is. I mean, it's, you know, whether it's Bach or what. I mean, it's just, it's all interesting harmonically, rhythmically, melodically. And to be able to take all of those ingredients and stick them on one guitar, and to keep the bass line going, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like, it's a challenge, but it's so cool, you know, to get up in the morning. It's like, I'm a guitar player. I get to do this, you know. And then I spend half the day taking care of business.
Now, any upcoming dates you want to mention?
You know, I just got done. Over the weekend, I was playing locally. I don't have anything booked yet, local at all. I'm actually kind of heading into a bit of a lull gig-wise. I'm going to Nashville on Friday because I'm co-arranging and supervising a musical called Part of the Plan that is all Dan Fogelberg songs.
Oh, very cool.
That's getting a developmental production at the Tennessee Performing Arts Center in Nashville.
Nice. Very awesome.
It goes up in September. And then We're going to Australia in February because they're doing a production of my wife Hope and I wrote Gilligan's Island the musical, and that's getting a
very
production
cool.
in Australia. So.
Very cool.
Just there's a lot of kind of stuff going on, and my daughter Ilse is really doing well as a songwriter now. So, kind of you know the kids have kind of got you know
they're
on
coming
a nice plateau,
yeah, yeah.
and I'm kind of at a point where it's okay. There's a lot of things on my radar, and I don't feel stressed to immediately do another album, and I've been doing a lot of gigs, so I'm kind of giving it a little bit of a rest.
That's okay.
You know,
that's
but then my agent kind of calls up, and all of a sudden I've got like a week in Arkansas.
Just everybody, check out www.lawrencejuber.com
yep.
in the site, and that'll tell you what's going on. And also, too, I want to mention... As always, Lori helped me put this together too, and she's. I just want to mention too that Lori's done a lot to help this show and just define the quality of the show with the guests that she brings on, and I just want to acknowledge that. I know I always thank you for making the show possible stuff, but you really do make a difference.
Thank
I just want to mention
so
that.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Lawrence, for saying yes to this.
Happy to be here.
And we definitely have to have you back on. I'd love to have you when the trio thing happens. We definitely. I mean, I could spend a whole show just talking about the history of Martin guitars with you. You
well,
are an encyclopedia.
Easily a show, yeah.
I mean,
well,
your knowledge is just amazing.
Amazing.
I'm going to take us out with "Honey Pie" from the new
okay.
album. Do you want to set it up?
Well, that was actually recorded on the old Martin, on the parlor guitar. You know, with this album, compared with the previous two, I gave myself more room just to be improvisational. So with Honey Pie in particular, I mean, the shape of it is from the original, but I kind of went off and, you know, into a little bit of my own space with it.
Well, thank you again for coming back on this show. And, Lori, I can't thank you enough.
You're
welcome. Thank you.
I just love this. There's a sense of humor to Honey Pie that's just so cool. I mean, I love the groove on it. But
this was like a one-take thing.
Anyway, everybody have a great week, and check this out. This is a really great cut. Have a good night. We'll see you next week.